And I said, will come for us all.
Hey, Samantha, where can they find us on the social medias?
I'm so glad you asked. They can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Reaper Tales Podcast and on TikTok at reaper.tales.podc. Just PODC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can email us at reapergals@reapertales.com. I'm always looking at it. So if you're one of the ones that emails me on a regular basis, you know that. I do respond almost in real time. Unless like
almost.
I'm on vacation or like I'm bed rotting, but that's a different thing. So email us at reapergals, G-A-L-S, at reapertales.com. Email me to tell me that I look pretty. Email me to tell me I'm doing a good job and to send us your show suggestions and anything else that you want us to cover or anything like that. So, yeah.
And please remember to like, rate, review, subscribe, all the things you lovely listeners know what to do anyway on any of the listening platforms that you use. As per usual, you get bonus points if you do it on platforms you don't listen to us on, but you give us a nice little review. And worded reviews will get special shout outs. So if you are so inclined to do so, please do us a favor. Makes it a little easier for people to find us. And if you don't want to be listed out, by the way, on the worded reviews, it's too bad. We're still going to give you a shout out.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you say we smell like boogers or something like that. Okay, thanks.
Rude.
Hello, I'm Montana.
And I'm Samantha.
And you're listening to
Reaper Tales. And today I'm going to tell Montana about another Black Widow from Florida. But first, Montana, what are we supposed to be drinking?
Well, that Florida, first off, this is going to be wild, I guess.
You're not wrong.
We're drinking the Black Widow. I think we've done this one before.
Yeah,
not
I'm pretty sure we have.
Sure.
I mean, it's a classic.
But you're going to need a handful of basil leaves, two blackberries, or, you know, just however many your heart desires.
Measure with your heart.
1.5 ounces of tequila, 1 ounce lime juice, 1 teaspoon of agave nectar, and some more basil leaves and blackberry for garnish. But in a shaker, you're going to muddle the basil leaves and blackberries. Yeah, we have done this. I remember it now. Add the tequila, lime juice, and agave with ice and shake until well chilled. Strain into a stemless cocktail glass or just, you know, whatever glass you have.
Whatever makes you feel fancy.
Yeah. You know, if you have that glass that you stole from a brewery, use that. It's typically what I use. I've never stolen a glass in my life on purpose.
Sure.
Garnish with basil leaves and blackberries on a skewer and enjoy. We didn't do that
at all.
I have a Truly. Yeah.
I have a White Claw, which is like never the case, but my husband went to a show yesterday and had some left over. So I just grabbed what was in the fridge. And normally I wouldn't drink, but after writing 15 pages in 2 days, I felt like it was okay.
Yeah, and
it was due.
I deserve one after the weekend I've had. So
you do. So cheers.
Anyways, Kelsey's drinking water. Cheers. No cheersing for Kelsey. It's bad luck.
And we don't need any of that either.
No. All right, tell me about this Florida Gator.
That would probably have been a better name for this one. So today I'm going to talk about Judy Buenoano, who is the Florida Black Widow. Y'all know Florida does stuff differently. In this case, is going to kind of show that. It's definitely a doozy, and there's actually a lot more information than I originally thought there would be when I stumbled across this person and decided to cover it. I was just like, okay, I've done the Black Widows in Alabama, so let's move to Florida because I'm sure they have some, and boy, was I not wrong. This has been covered by several other podcasts, so this is unique that it's a little bit more popular, but I had never heard of her, so I wouldn't say it's up there and like one of the most popular cases. But it's a doozy, and I'm going to handle this one a little bit differently. I'm actually going to be a little bit more detailed in the victims and what they went through in the hospital versus as much detail in the trials, just because the trials start kind of getting redundant and there's a lot more information that's revealed. But honestly, it's kind of like every other Black Widow trial where they're like, how could you say I would do that? I loved him. And then it's like, but really, I just wanted money, or really, he just got on my nerves. So I didn't do as much detail when it comes to the trial part of it. But depending on what you like.
I wonder if there's a Black Widow handbook. They just follow the same trope, you know?
There might be. I could probably put one together by the time I get done with some of these.
No kidding.
From every state. I have a feeling we're going to cover one from every state. I'm going to try anyway.
Hey, I believe in you.
We're going to have a calendar. So in any case, this one will probably be long. It's going to be at least two parts, possibly three. It really is just going to depend on how much Montana has to say. And I have a feeling she might have some questions and things to say. So
I'm not that talkative. Buckle
up, listeners. I hope you are, because it'll make this even more interesting today.
That's so rude.
So here we go. Judias, or I guess it's Judias, is the actual name. Anna Lou Welty, a.k.a. Judias Buenoano, a.k.a. Judias Goodyear, a.k.a. Judy Morris, a.k.a. Judy Buenoano, a.k.a. a bunch of other aliases, because I ran out of patience typing them
Goodyear?
Up. Goodyear?
Goodyear
was one of her...
entire fortune?
No.
No. Oh, damn.
No. If Do you only. Think they would have let her anywhere near anybody in their family? Absolutely not.
Well,
in any case,
fair.
She was born on April 4th, 1943 in Quanah, Hardeman County, Texas, to Ziah Jesse Otto, an itinerant farm worker, and Judias Mary Lou Northam, who was full-blooded Apache Indian. We're going to get into some interesting things about that whole part of it, but this is her story. Judias claimed the Apache chief Geronimo was related to her. According to Judias, her mother died from tuberculosis like 10 out of her 13 siblings when she was just 2 years old and her brother Robert was still a newborn.
Wait. Okay, I'm butting in. Is she just claiming to be Native American? This is a trope. That's what I got. Go on.
Well, I mean, she's from Texas. She moves around a lot in that general area, so that's not unheard of, right? So we'll see. A lot of people, let's just put it this way. Historically, a lot of people that actually had some Spanish/Mexican descent would rather claim Indian descent than Hispanic.
Yeah. No, that's what I was thinking too. Also, it's not uncommon for people to claim that they have Native heritage and they get their ancestry back and they're like, what? I'm all European.
Yeah, so I was thinking like, ooh, those DNA tests are spilling some tea lately.
Yeah.
There's been some real revelations from what I've heard. She still had two other brothers after her mother had died, but they were entered into the system for adoption while she and her younger brother, Robert, went to live with their grandmother.
That's mean.
Yeah, I really don't know why you would do it that way, unless maybe her older brothers were maybe not her dad's.
Oh.
It's the only thing I can think of. Or maybe they were and he didn't want them. I don't know. The thing I'm thinking is between the four of them, the split, one of them had a different parent somewhere there.
Okay. Gotcha.
That's my guess. But there's no specification and it's not explained.
Well.
According to Judias, because I think she lost track of her older siblings and she didn't really care to know what happened to them. So.
Well, if she can't murder them for profit, I'm assuming she doesn't care.
Probably not. Well, according to her, when she was 12 years old, her father remarried. She claimed this was the seventh time he had remarried. And she and Robert were sent to live with their father and new stepmother in Roswell, New Mexico. While living there, she and Robert were badly abused by both her father and her stepmother. They were, quote, beaten, starved, burned with cigarettes, and much else. She was treated like a servant and forced to miss meals if even a spot of grease was found on the stove she had cleaned. She had to sit at the table and watch the rest of the family eat. One time, when she had missed 17 meals in about 2 weeks, her stepmother started beating Robert again, and Jedias just blew up. She grabbed a pan from the stove, pouring hot grease on two of her stepbrothers, and got into a fist fight with her stepmother. She started swinging and kicking and throwing things at her father and stepmother until she said she darned near killed them. She was 14 years old at this point and was taken and locked into a cell for 60 days with adult women, some of whom were drunks and others were prostitutes.
Okay, which is probably safer there.
Yeah. When the judge asked her whether she wanted to return home, she said she didn't. So she was placed in a juvenile detention center at Foothills High School in Albuquerque, New Mexico, until she graduated in May 1959 at the age of 16, end quote.
That's pretty horrible. Also, I have a question about the 17 meals. That's very specific. Is it like 17 meals, 3 meals a day, or is it 17 days? Because you can only go 21
No, it was 17 meals over the course of 2 weeks.
Okay.
So 14
okay.
days.
So 14 days. Like you can only.
So she's keeping track, which I don't blame you. I mean, I would too. I don't skip meals intentionally.
Honey, I can't go 2 hours without eating. Come on.
Why would you if it's an option?
Right.
So when asked later about her brother and what happened to him, she said she didn't have anything to do with him and, quote, I wouldn't spit down his throat if his guts were on fire, end quote. So I guess they had a falling out at some point.
Oh. That's also a very specific thread.
Yeah. So that's it for her early years. I couldn't really find a whole lot of information. After high school, there really wasn't a lot of information until the birth of her oldest son, Michael Bueno Ono. And at the time, his last name was Schultz. He was born March 30th, 1961, when Judy was 19 in Roswell, New Mexico. According to the birth certificate, he was born Michael Arthur Schultz, and Judy was going by the name of Ann Lou Welty, a.k.a. Ann Schultz, at the time.
Okay. Do I need, like, a diagram of these names?
You might, actually. So there was a part in the book that I read, which the book was called Bodies of Evidence, and they actually cover several different cases, and it's quite thorough. There's a part where they say that it was suspected that Michael's father and her got married at some point, but he was in the military and he died. But I didn't have any specific information about what his name was. I mean, they had a birth certificate, so I would think they had his name, but maybe not. Who knows? There was a lot going on. And you'll find out she's very imaginative in talking about her background. So
it was the 60s,
it's
right?
Kind of hard to know. Yeah, that was the 60s. So there was a lot less record keeping and fact checking.
Yeah, but Vietnam was going on. Right?
Yeah, that'll come up later. That was in the 70s.
Okay, 70s. All right. End of 60s, early 70s, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was ending early 70s. So between 61 and 62, 61 through the end of 61, she was just kind of with her son, not a lot of information. Then she met Air Force Sergeant James Goodyear, and they were married January 19th, 1962. Making Sergeant Goodyear Judy's first official husband, because like I said, she took the name Schultz and her son's name was Schultz, but I don't know that there was an actual marriage certificate at any point in time, so I don't know.
Doesn't matter.
Apparently
she's
people
that,
could just say what their name was at this time from
she's got that Goodyear money now.
You. Yeah.
She sure. can have all the tires she wants. Lucky.
Hey, that could come in handy later. Quote, James E. Goodyear had adopted Michael, changing his name to Goodyear in 1966. On January 16, 1966, Michael's half-brother was born, James Goodyear. In 1967, the Goodyears moved to Orlando, Florida, where Kimberly Goodyear was born. So there's now three. And she's now in Florida. So that's
Michael, James, and Kimberly.
Yep.
Okay.
In that order. After they moved to Orlando, Judy opened up the Conway Acres Child Care Center with her husband as co-owner, even though he was still working with the Air Force. In fact, shortly after moving, he had to go overseas for a tour of duty in Vietnam. That's how I knew when that was.
Yeah, gotcha.
Because he does go overseas. Sergeant Goodyear died September 16th, 1971, in Orlando, Florida, with the official cause of death being named natural causes.
Sure.
Here's a bit more detail of what he endured from the Bodies of Evidence book that I referenced. By the way, in case you weren't keeping up, so in 1966, they moved, or 1967, they moved to Orlando, Florida, lived there. At some point, he went overseas for a tour of duty in Vietnam, came back, and September 16th, 1971, he was dead. So made it through Vietnam, got home, then died. Quote, James Edgar Goodyear, a 37-year-old male USAF technical sergeant, was admitted to the Naval Hospital in Orlando, Florida on September 13th, 1971, with a two-week history of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and abdominal liver failure test. He had returned from South Vietnam 3 months prior, following a one-year tour of duty. During that time, he took his antimalarials and was not ill. He returned to the United States in June of 1971, and since that time had not been feeling well, tending to tire easily, associated with a decrease in appetite and an increased abdominal distension.
Arsenic.
2 weeks prior to admission, he developed nausea and repeated episodes of vomiting. He had chills and a daily fever of 100 plus 1 degree. He developed cramping abdominal pain and diarrhea with no apparent blood or mucus. He had noticed a darkening of his urine, and Ms. Goodyear stated that she thought his sclera were esoteric, which means the yellowing of the white of the eyes, which is typically a sign of jaundice or liver failure.
Mm-hmm.
He went to McCoy Dispensary and had been sent there at 2 to 3 day intervals since the onset of nausea and vomiting. So he was going to the doctor when this started, just to clarify. In addition, within the past 2 days, he noted tingling and numbness of his fingers and toes, as well as diffuse myalgias without any joint pain. Due to the persistence of his symptoms, he was referred to the Orlando Naval Hospital for further evaluation.
Do you know what the symptoms of malaria are?
No, but I bet Kelsey can look them up real quick.
Yeah, because I'm like, is it even close to malaria?
Fever, chills, general feeling of discomfort, headache, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain, muscle or joint pain.
Almost exactly. Real quick, can you look and see if the anti-malaria drugs were 100% effective? Because I'm like, that's a great excuse.
Yeah, there's a lot of those in here. It works out really well in her favor.
I mean, it says that it was found to be as effective as current anti-malaria
drugs.
That's
surprising.
Huh.
That is surprising.
I mean, I think they're probably made pretty much the same way. They're probably from the disease to help prevent you from succumbing to it in some way, shape, or form.
And it says highly effective, but not 100%.
Right.
Vaccines aren't even 100%.
I mean, I guess they can't say anything's 100%, really.
That's where we're leaning with this. That's why they didn't necessarily suspect her. But also, back then, they didn't suspect people of arsenic poisoning unless basically they were given some kind of proof or evidence that might be a possibility, or they were asked specifically to test for it.
Especially gasp a woman.
Right, exactly. So it said, this man, and this was a quote, still continuing with the quote from the book. This man has 19 years of service in the Air Force and is stationed at McCoy Air Force Base, where he worked as a mechanic. He's married with 2 children and until the onset of illness smoked 1 pack of cigarettes per day. He has no history of excessive alcohol consumption. His wife related that since the onset of the illness, he had been disoriented and manifested bizarre behavior and picking at himself. On physical examination, the patient appeared chronically ill and in mild distress. There was evidence of dehydration and guarding of the abdomen without other specific findings. On admission, the differential diagnosis was exhaustive. The leading candidate was some sort of parasitic infestation or inflammatory disease. Laboratory studies showed a relative anemia and changes consistent with hepatitic, I guess, and pancreatic inflammation and behavior consistent with cerebral irritability.
I think it's just hepatic.
Okay, that's right? What I had on there. It just didn't look right.
H-E-P-A-T-I-C.
Hepatic. Okay. I just looked wrong somehow. He was begun on forced fluids, developing labored respirations and pulmonary edema due to the fluid overload. Despite this, he had very little urinary output. On September 16th, he spiked a 103-degree temperature and developed labored respiration and an episode of hypertension. He developed respiratory arrest and subsequent cardiac arrest with ventricular fibrillation. Cardiorespiratory resuscitative measures were promptly instituted, but no stable rhythm could be obtained. After 60 minutes, the resuscitation was ended and the patient was pronounced dead at 5:15 p.m. on September 16th, 1971. By the way, 3 days after he was admitted.
Yikes. He was already an organ failure.
Yeah. I mean, he was.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was real bad once they finally got him in the hospital. The clinical diagnosis on James Edgar Goodyear listed septicemia, bronchopneumonia, renal failure, ulceration of the ileocecal valve and ascending colon, which is basically an ulcer at the beginning of the large intestine to the colon from when I looked it up. Also cause unknown for that, and cardiorespiratory arrest, terminal. So going through all of that with him, but all of the things, anything in particular stick out to you? You already mentioned one part about the anti-malarial drugs that they might have thought that it had something to do with malaria, but anything else?
I don't know. It's a little bit weird that he had bronchitis, it seems, on top of all that. I mean, I guess not. He could be aspirating into his lungs, which causes bronchitis.
That's what it sounded like was happening.
I find it weird that his symptoms continued even though he was going to the doctor and he was hospitalized.
That's one.
I guess she was bringing him food in the hospital.
Or something.
Or she had been poisoning him for so long that it was still in his system. I don't know. But the same thing, Montana, I thought, well, he's still getting sick even in the hospital.
And yeah.
So I will explain later how if it is arsenic poisoning, by the way, that actually can still happen without being given continuous additional servings of it. I'll go into the treatment of it and what it takes to get it out of your system.
But also at the point that he was hospitalized, he was already septic and he was in renal failure. So it's once you're septic, I mean, it's a pretty low chance that you kind of get out of that. I mean, it's better nowadays, but especially like back then, you really can't.
You have to know what it is. If you're going to recover at that point.
And where it started.
So, I mean, if you're trying to figure out what it is, you're already out of time. 3 days. That's all he had.
He had a heart attack, basically, but that's not actually that weird. If he's in, you know, renal failure, if all of his organs are shutting down, of course, your heart is also going to be a part of that. He was picking at his skin, which sounds like, I don't know, hallucinations.
Drugs.
And drugs, yeah, but that could also just be a side effect of arsenic poisoning. I'm not sure. Unless she was spiking something else.
Your brain, your cognitive abilities are not so great. So it can definitely lead to like hallucinations and that sort of thing. So picking at yourself, you could like think there's something on your skin.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not that far of a
but
jump.
That's also a symptom of like withdrawals from something. So I don't know. What did I miss?
No, those were the two big things. I think the biggest thing for me was I was surprised it took so long for them to admit him to a hospital and to have him really evaluated, because it said that he was he was going every 2 to 3 days because he was having all these issues, but it went on for at least a couple of months and nobody did anything until he was almost dead. And then they're like, oh, we should probably start figuring out what this is. It's getting serious. And then by that time, he had 3 days.
Well, you also have to think he's a man.
Yeah, that's very true.
And I don't know if your man's, I know my man's, did not want to go to the doctor. So, anyway.
It'll pass. I'll be fine.
Yeah. I
can barely breathe and I don't really want to eat, but it'll be fine.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Men, that's what we're saying. We're telling you to go to the doctor. Just do it.
If we're telling you to go
to the doctor, we're probably not poisoning you and it probably is serious. So just go.
Yeah, probably.
Notice I said probably. After Goodyear's death, Judy received $28,000 in military life insurance benefits and military death benefits. According to Judy, she moved to Pensacola, Florida because the housing was less expensive. But It was found that shortly before the move, her home in Orlando burned to the ground, which paid Judy $90,000 in fire insurance. Not suspicious at all.
Hang on. I'm looking at the conversion. Okay. $28,000 in 1970 is worth $226,724 today. Yikes.
And $90,000, which she got for the house?
$90,000 would be $728,757. Girl was a millionaire.
Yeah, I mean, she was making bank on that insurance money.
Mm-hmm.
So while living in Pensacola, a social worker visited their home and made a report. This is not uncommon when there's a death in the family. You're left with one person. She's currently receiving military benefits because he has passed. It's not uncommon for them to check and make sure that the kids still have a stable life and that they're being taken care of. So it's not because they suspected anything. But according to the social worker, she stated that Mrs. Goodyear, quote, is an attractive lady of about 32 years old. She's fairly tall, large boned woman, which became more evident as she discussed her Indian heritage. Miss Goodyear's parents were full-blooded Mesquite Apache Indians. She's the great-granddaughter of Geronimo. Her mother died of tuberculosis when Judy was only 18 months old. Judy's two older brothers were placed out for adoption. She went to live with her grandparents. We've already heard all of that. She was placed in a county welfare home, so this was a little bit different. It wasn't juvenile detention. This time, it's a county welfare home for children until she graduated high school at the age of 16. She made good grades and received a scholarship in the field of nursing. She married Mr. Goodyear at age 18 and finished her nursing education while they were stationed in Lincoln, Nebraska. By the way, the Mesquite Apache tribe was found to be non-existent and completely fabricated by Judy, just FYI.
Called that. Yeah.
They actually asked. Yeah. They actually asked a Native American to, just to be clear, and he was, yeah, no, that doesn't exist, but cool.
Also, why does it matter if she's attractive? Why is that in an official report? What the fuck? The 70s are wild.
It'll be mentioned later the opposite. So, you know, that's always just a question of taste anyway. So I don't understand why that even matters. But sure, right? Whatever. Anything stand out to you that time?
Yeah, I mean, obviously she changed her story. And she said that she was a nurse. I highly doubt she was a nurse. Everything that she said, I mean, it made it sound like she was from a troubled past. But at the same time, it put her in a good light, you know?
Look where I came from, but what have I accomplished?
Right. She's really good at manipulating to make herself seem better.
Yeah, all the other stuff that I had said before, that whole instance with the stepmom and the dad, she repeated mm-hmm. that to the social worker. I just left that out because we've already talked about it. So I like skipped a whole paragraph of stuff that she told her that she had already.
Yeah, but even in that situation, it makes her sound like she's like the hero. So I mean, I'm not here to like say that, you know, somebody's abuse isn't there. But with the way that she kind of manipulates and the way that she fabricates and, you know, makes things sound worse or better based on what she needs, I would say, yeah, she probably suffered abuse. That's apparent, but it doesn't have to be as severe as what she said. And so.
Yeah. So remember that this is going to be a theme.
Oh, just FYI, okay.
Because we're just getting started.
Yay.
All right. So from the time he was quite young, Judy remembers having difficulty with Michael, the oldest. Apparently, he had a long history of pica. For those of you who do not know, pica is a disorder where the person compulsively swallows non-food items. According to the Cleveland Clinic website, this disorder is especially common in children and can be caused by stress, cultural factors, nutritional deficiencies, mental health conditions, or pregnancy. And why pregnancy comes up, I have no idea, but it came up multiple times. So somehow pregnancy can make you eat non-food items. I don't really understand.
Well, it can make you psychotic too, so.
Well, that's Kelsey.
Kelsey's like, yeah, that's that true.
So it's funny that you say that. When you're going to the doctor, they ask you, they make sure that you don't like eat things that are not edible. But a lot of women have the desire to chew on ice. Like they want to bite ice. Like, I don't know. It like, say, it, I guess, soothes that thing. I have
the
no idea.
Thing?
But
yeah.
I was never like that. Okay. The pica thing. Yeah. Like if you chew on ice, then whatever your urge to eat is will like go away, I guess. I don't know.
A lot of people who have babies also have like body image issues. And so I could see if you're getting larger and you don't want to eat and gain weight, but you have that like need to eat. Kelsey, you've never been shy from eating ever a day in your life, which girl after my own heart. But so it, you know, that could be, you know, one of the reasons why you never like try to deny yourself your nutrition. So it didn't occur. Now that we've dissected Pika.
Well, yeah. So often the disorder can be normal and manageable, but sometimes it can cause major problems, especially if the person consumes toxic or dangerous items. Fun fact, the name actually comes from a bird with the same name that has a reputation for eating unusual objects, which I thought was kind of interesting. Oh. It's a magpie, and it'll actually just eat things that are not actual food. That's why the disorder is named that.
I wonder if Seven's actually a pika instead of a dog.
Maybe. Who knows?
She just eats anything.
She's small enough.
Yeah.
The disorder can cause many health issues throughout the person's lifetime, including anemia, constipation, electrolyte imbalance, irregular heart rhythms, lead poisonings, small and or large intestine obstruction, and blockage, which, duh, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Including worse things like cuts or something. Because I think they had that show that was My Strange Addiction. And a lot of people were covered on that one for doing that type of thing. They would like swallow glass and screws. So those are sharp and they can perforate your bowels and your stomach lining. So obviously it could be very serious, but typically it's not.
I only remember the toilet paper one where the person ate just toilet paper constantly, which also terrible. It'll cause blockages. Yeah, 100%. And then the other one who ate her partner's ashes, I think. Yeah.
That sounds familiar.
His cigarette ashes?
Was it I thought it was his disgusting. Actual ashes, like his.
No. He was just a smoker.
Okay.
Well, what a way to keep the earth clean.
Hey, that's one way to do it. I don't think that's really good for your body, though.
Yeah, don't do that. Don't do that. There's no nutritional value there. So I just thought I would mention that little piece that'll come in later.
Well, I mean, if I had a mother like her.
Yeah, and that's why I said stress can definitely cause that. Mental health conditions definitely cause that. And the reason why I bring that up is because that's also one reason why the social worker was there. Judy was trying to get him adopted out at some point, because she said she didn't have the capacity to give him the care that he needed and that he should be with a family that didn't have any other kids. Now, what does that sound like to you?
That sounds like what she grew up in.
Well, it sounds to me like an adoption agency for animals where they say this dog is dog aggressive. It should be in a house that only has this dog. Like, she was basically telling them, not only do I want you to adopt him out, I don't want to lose my other two kids. I just think he deserves more attention, so you should give him to a family that doesn't have any other kids. I'm too busy with my other two.
What an asshole.
In case you didn't like her enough yet. So, yeah.
I know that some people, like, it's a very special situation, especially right now with Roe v. Wade being overturned, but some people truly can't take care of children. But she has the funds. I know she has the capability. She just didn't want to. You know?
Certainly seems that way. But not if you ask her.
Okay, sure.
She met Bobby Joe Morris in Pensacola, Florida in 1973, where they began living together. Bobby Joe was born in 1941 to parents Austin Morris and Lodell Hall Morris in Alabama. Bobby Joe was described as 32 years old, 220 pounds, and 6'3" tall.
So he's like the size of my husband.
Pretty big dude, honestly. Not overly, though. I mean, that would be about right, 220 pounds for six foot three. I mean, he was pretty tall.
He's like a middleman of what? The middle ground of Paul and Council.
Yeah, basically. In 1977, Bobby Joe moved to Trinidad, Colorado, and only 6 months later, Judias and her children followed right behind him after her second home unfortunately burned to the ground, and she collected money for fire insurance for that home as well. So that is, and I didn't have a dollar amount for that. I couldn't find it, but there's some more insurance money. Shortly after this, she began going by Judias Morris, despite the fact that I couldn't find anything that said that they were ever officially married. Judy just said it made things easier for her to take his name.
Oh, okay.
So apparently back then was a wild time because you could just call yourself whatever name you wanted to and that became your name.
Sure. I mean, I do it every recording.
Which was interesting because she does that a lot. Yeah, well, that's true. But that's just for a recording. That's not to live a different life. It's a little different.
Some days.
A little bit.
Some days I wish.
Also, little note here for a weird random occurrence that later was tied to Judy from murderpedia.org, and it was also mentioned in the book. Quote, in 1974, Judy and Bobby Joe had been visiting Morris's hometown of Brewton, Alabama, when a male resident of Florida was found dead in a Brewton motel. An anonymous call traced to a local payphone led police to the room where the victim was found, shot in the chest with a .22 caliber weapon, his throat slashed for good measure. After the news broke, Bobby Joe's mother overheard Judy telling Bobby Joe, the son of a bitch shouldn't have come up here in the first place. He knew if he came up here, he was going to die. Later, raving in delirium on his deathbed, Morris blurted out, Judy, we should have never done that terrible thing. Police in Brewton, meanwhile, report that they could find no fingerprints inside the room, no bullet was ever recovered from the corpse, and they had no suspects in the case. So it was tied to her, but...
Who was this person?
That's all the information. It was just some random person that they didn't know that... I mean, there was a name, I'm sure, but they never found a suspect, and they never had anything on the case, so I don't know that the name was ever released, or if it was, I didn't see it.
Okay.
So... Yeah. Okay. On January 4th, 1978, Bobby Joe was admitted to San Rafael, I guess it's Rafael, Hospital in Trinidad, Colorado, in shock. To give you a detailed look at what this man went through, here's the description from the book Bodies of Evidence. This one's a good bit longer because, unfortunately, he suffered for a much longer period of time than Mr. Goodyear did. And it's also a good bit different in his case. Quote, he had felt great 24 hours before, but at 5 p.m. on the day of admission, he suddenly became very nauseated and started vomiting. He developed severe abdominal pain in the epigastric area associated with diarrhea that was eggshell in color. Upon examination, his amylase level was found to be elevated, but all other signs were normal. The cause of shock was unknown. Since he had been in shock for several hours, his heart rate was increased, and he had no urine output in that period. He was also in metabolic acidosis, which in layman's term means acid that builds up in your body, causing accelerated heart rate, confusion, fatigue. Causes can include diabetes, hypochromatic acidosis from taking too many laxatives or having severe diarrhea, or lactic acidosis, which is from liver failure, low blood sugar, alcohol use disorder, cancer, or even intense exercise can cause it. So basically, it's a buildup of acid in your body.
Mm-hmm.
Morris was treated immediately for shock. He was given an infusion of IV solution for his dehydration and dopamine to bring up his blood pressure. I didn't know you could just get a dose of dopamine. There you go.
I would like
to the hospital.
Just a shot of that every day.
I would just like a shot of dopamine, please.
Oh, wait. I already get that.
Yeah, that's true. He was placed in intensive care and his electrolytes were monitored very closely. By January 6th, he appeared to be clinically improving, but that evening he developed delirium tremens. Morris had been a heavy drinker. His wife, Judas Morris, revealed that to the attending physician that her husband had been drinking at least 2 cases of beer per day for the past several years. He began having muscle twitching hallucinations. He became disoriented and very difficult to manage. The patient was in full-blown delirium tremens. The doctors now felt that alcohol withdrawal was perhaps the cause of shock. Morris was given a shot of 10 milligrams of Librium every 4 hours and started on aqua, mefitin, and thiamine for possible liver problems. By January 7th, Morris had become more agitated and belligerent. His talking was wild and confused, and he suffered horrible hallucinations. He remained in delirium tremens with fever, increased heart rate, and sweating. His metabolic problems included increased sodium, increased potassium, and increased chloride with very low calcium. He was unable to tolerate any oral medications. His metabolic acidosis continued, and he remained dehydrated regardless of the amount of fluids he received. On January 9th, he went into congestive heart failure. His delirium raged on. He developed severe respiratory distress and had to be treated with oxygen. Later that day, Morris started to come out of his delirium and was able to carry on a somewhat sensible conversation for short periods. However, he fluctuated in and out of hallucinations and agitation. His kidney status improved, but his calcium remained very low, as did his platelets. His amylase finally began to increase, confirming a probable diagnosis for the shock as severe pancreatitis. How many diagnoses have we been through right now? I think we're at 3 now.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, he was more conversive, although still confused and disoriented. His congestive heart failure was improving, but the diabetes continued. Within a few days, Morris was lucid and his chest was much clearer. By January 14th, he was completely oriented. On January 15th, the patient developed a urinary tract infection and was started on intravenous Keflin. And I know what that is. It's an intravenous antibiotic, basically.
Mm-hmm.
He developed a rash on his trunk, and this was thought to be a possible reaction to the drug Keflin, so that was discontinued. Nevertheless, he was seemingly recovering. By January 16th, the pancreatitis seemed resolved, and he was started on clear liquids. In 2 days, he was very stable, completely coherent. The IV was discontinued, and his diet was increased. By January 21st, he was well enough to walk around the room, and Morris was discharged with a follow-up examination scheduled in a week's time. The attending's final diagnosis listed: delirium tremens, acute pancreatitis, alcoholic hepatitis, hypotension with shock, metabolic acidosis, acute renal failure, congestive heart failure, urinary tract infection, possible drug reaction to Keflin, and diabetes completely resolved. What? You don't think that any of those are related
right.
to each other?
But a lot of those are symptoms of alcoholism, too.
Well, withdrawal from...
Yeah.
Yeah, they are. Quite a lot of them. So that's why they kind of just went with that diagnosis. Yeah,
but she's also the one who said it, not him.
Exactly. They never got that from him. 2 days later, on January 23rd, 1978, Bobby Joe Morris was readmitted to the ER at San Rafael Hospital, again in a state of shock for no apparent reason. According to his wife, the day after he returned home, he began to vomit uncontrollably and to have severe diarrhea. The wife told the doctor she had not become concerned until he became very weak and fainted every time he tried to sit up. Upon admission, Morris's blood pressure was not audible, either lying down or sitting up. His chest was clear and his heart showed normal rhythm with a very rapid rate. He was awake and oriented. He had no urine output for the past 12 hours. He was treated as before for shock with fluids and drugs to raise his blood pressure. By the following morning, he appeared to be doing fairly well, though his calcium remained low, a condition thought to be due to his continuing pancreatitis. On the evening of January 24th, he began to go downhill very rapidly. With rapid heartbeat and severe metabolic acidosis, his blood pressure plummeted and he became swollen. Suspecting massive infection, the attending physician prescribed broad-spectrum antibiotics and steroids, which is typical. The next day, the patient seemed to respond, but on the 26th, he began to be restrained. He was taken from intensive care to a private room where he continued to deteriorate rapidly. On January 28th, he was tested for lupus with negative results. It's important that that's mentioned. The metabolic lupus. Acidosis for which there was no known cause continued. On January 28th, 1978, Bobby Joe Morris had severe arrhythmia. His heart stopped at 7:20 a.m. Resuscitation began, but after all signs and symptoms of brain death, it was stopped at approximately 7:56 a.m. The final hospital report listed massive sepsis with septic shock, metabolic acidosis, possible hepatic encephalopathy. I had all of these down, but like when I get in front of the mic, it gets harder. Hypotension and death. A chronic pancreatitis diagnosis was made upon autopsy. The cause of death was thought to be severe hypotension with lactic acidosis and arrhythmia secondary to acidosis resulting in cardiac arrest. Now, remember why they thought he had all of this before.
Yeah,
it was alcoholism. An alcohol abuse disorder.
Yeah.
Bobby Joe Morris's death certificate signed by his attending physician, Dr. Charles Ray, listed the immediate cause of death as cardiac arrhythmia and arrest due to metabolic acidosis as a consequence of possible systematic lupus erythematosus, but he tested negative.
What is lupus?
Interesting. All right, Kelsey, I'll let you do that. To further, the death certificate listed Morris's surviving spouse as Judeus Welty, and the informant was Mrs. Judeus Morris. So interesting that they listed her as a spouse, even though I don't think they were actually married.
Yeah.
Lupus is an autoimmune disease. It occurs in when your body's immune system attacks its own tissue and organs. Inflammation caused by lupus can affect many different body systems, including your joints, skin, kidneys, blood cells, brain, heart, and lungs.
Is it like a hereditary disease? Are you able to develop lupus, or is this like a genetic thing?
I think you can develop it, but I could be wrong.
Like you're born with it, you know?
It says that it is genetic. Certain genes may make a person more likely to develop lupus. These genes may carry instructions for proteins that affect the immune system. Lupus also runs in families, but there also can be environmental factors. So
okay.
UVA, UVB rays from the sun. Yeah. Okay. Infections. It goes on.
Okay. I just didn't know if it was like, you know, a lot of like autoimmune diseases, like you're born with it. You've got it from like day one. I didn't know if lupus was like one of those or if it is something that could develop over time or like environment or what have you. So, okay. But he also tested negative. So,
right. That's the thing. He tested negative, but then they listed it as a possible cause of death, which is confusing, but okay. Sure. An autopsy was performed by Dr. John Altshuler, a pathologist called in from Denver, Colorado. His postmortem examination stated that all organs removed, heart, lungs, spleen, kidneys, pancreas, and bowel appeared normal. Microscopic examination showed the organ tissues were normal and non-malignant, with the exception of the pancreas, which revealed extensive fibrosis and mild chronic inflammatory reaction. The tissue pathology report concluded the cause of death in the patient is obscure as his clinical course during his terminal illness in the hospital. There are no anatomic lesions that would account for his death. One questions the possibility of some form of toxicity. During the last few days of his life, the patient had toxicity screen performed and phenothiazines, which, according to the Mayo Clinic, they are used to treat serious mental and emotional disorders, including schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders. Some are used to control agitation in certain patients, severe nausea and vomiting, severe hiccups, and moderate to severe pain in some hospitalized patients. But those were found to be present in his urine and his blood. But at this time, the cause of death remains obscure. So what stuck out in the autopsy?
Did they prescribe that to him?
I didn't say that that was not prescribed. So it probably was just because he was being so agitated at the beginning. Yeah. And they were trying to control that. Although, I don't know. I don't know that they would have. It wasn't specified one way or another in the autopsy. He just said that he found it. And I don't remember it being mentioned in the book, but I mean, they could have, but also I'd be surprised with everything else that was going on that they would be worried about that rather than.
I guess my thing is like they did a toxicity screening. Did they not have like, well, I guess this was still early days. Was arsenic not on it?
So they didn't specifically, you had to specifically ask to be tested for that, basically.
Okay.
Specifically for arsenic.
Okay. Well, all of his organs seemed okay, except for he did have cirrhosis, but that could be, or he didn't have cirrhosis. He had mild cirrhosis.
He didn't have cirrhosis. He had extensive fibrosis and mild chronic inflammatory in his pancreas.
Okay. Okay. I thought you said cirrhosis, and I was like, well, that does lead
to alcohol. That would make sense since he was supposedly having a problem with alcohol, but the liver seemed normal according to the autopsy. All of the organs seemed normal except for the pancreas.
Yeah. I don't really know what the pancreas does, so I'm not a doctor.
Well, that's why I tried to explain a lot of the things in here, and I figured Kelsey could look up all the things that you bring up.
Yeah. I know fibromyalgia, that's like a painful autoimmune response, right? And then
that's unexplained. They don't know what causes it. Kind of a catch-all diagnosis.
I guess fibrous, whatever, pancreas.
Fibroids are growths.
Okay. All right, Kelsey.
If you have fibrosis, you have growth of fibroids.
Okay.
The pancreas has dual roles in the digestive and the hormonal system. So it helps digest enzymes and break down fluids, fats, proteins, carbs, but then it also produces hormones that regulate your blood sugar, appetite, and stomach function.
So that's where, which would make sense
since he was having diabetes and yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I just know Tugger's had my dog, my little dog, he's had pancreatitis before. And all I know that it does is that it made him shit blood everywhere. So, you know, enjoy that image, everybody.
It's definitely important to the body. Let's clarify that real quick. I just thought it was interesting that they were going off of this idea that he had alcohol abuse disorder, but his liver was fine. Like, if you have been abusing alcohol for any length of time, your liver does not look normal.
No.
It can't.
No, it can't.
So that's a red flag, in my opinion. But neither here nor there, because nobody said anything about it at the time. Because why would you? It's just a mystery.
Also, was it husband one that smoked a pack of cigarettes a day?
One pack, yeah. One pack of cigarettes a day with no alcohol abuse issues.
All right. Well, I was like, well, if his lungs look good, how did he smoke a pack of cigarettes a day?
Yeah, they said his lungs look normal, I think.
Okay.
Weird. But, you know, cigarettes were a little different in the 70s versus even 20 years ago.
Fair.
So that's neither here nor there. Anyway. So one thing that was discovered by detectives later was that Thorazine was found in his system. That's where it comes up, where he had something in his system that was not prescribed by his doctor, which can cause low blood pressure and thus was not provided by the hospital to the patient while he was there, as both times he was admitted, he had low blood pressure. And so they were trying to fix that problem. So they would have at no time given him Thorazine.
Right.
At the time Morris was admitted, Judias was working as a licensed practical nurse at the hospital Morris was admitted and paid extra special attention to him, something that one of the attending physicians noticed and was very suspicious of, enough to try to keep an eye on her patient whenever possible.
I don't think she was actually a nurse. How is she working there?
She did manage to get her license at some point, or at least she forged it.
Okay. I'm going to lean towards she forged it.
I mean, this was at the same time of the Catch Me If You Can, and he just basically printed off degrees and told them, hey, I'm a doctor, and they took it, and they were like, okay, cool, sounds totally legit. Here, run the ward. So,
I think it's really weird that he has, quote-unquote, alcohol, you know, abuse disorder, and that's what they think it is, but he's coming in with low blood pressure. That's immediate red flag, because typically they have really high normal blood pressure. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of red flags here.
What kind of doctors were these?
They were doing their best with the information provided. The internet wasn't available at the time.
Okay.
The coroner also reported that Judias rushed him, stating the body had to be prepared to be buried in Florida. And the doctor that performed the autopsy on Morris said he conducted the autopsy while the body was in the coffin and after embalming. Thus, it was not a proper autopsy.
What? Well, I'm surprised she didn't just go ahead and cremate him.
She couldn't. Because after his death, she received $50,000 in life insurance benefits. So you had to have an autopsy because the cause of death was unknown.
Oh.
And not concrete.
Yeah, if you embalm that body, a lot of that evidence is just gonna go away.
Yeah, I don't. That's a little odd at best. I don't know how the insurance company even accepted that autopsy, to be perfectly frank, but I guess he just didn't mention it to them, and they were like, "Okay, cool. I guess he did die of a sickness. Well, I guess we should go ahead and pay it out."
Well, she was an attractive woman.
That sucks. According to one person, at least. Shortly after that, she also changed her and her children's names legally to Bueno Ano, which is supposed to be the Spanish equivalent of Goodyear, which is apparently a tribute to her late husband, Goodyear, and her claimed heritage from her mom.
Wait, so that's Spanish.
Yeah.
She's changing ancestry again?
No. I don't really understand how that works out.
Okay, girl. She's doing too much.
Oh, we're only two in.
Yikes.
So she's now lost at least two husbands, sort of, live-in boyfriend and husband, maybe two husband, like the Michael's dad and Goodyear, maybe Morris. I don't know if he was boyfriend or husband, whatever. So obviously that's not where she's going to end. There's definitely some more in the future, but also, I don't.
That guy that was shot. in the hotel, yeah, motel, we, whatever.
But that wasn't somebody that was like necessarily close to her. And I don't think that she had any monetary gain from that. Unless maybe he had something to do with one of the fires to one of the houses or something like that. What, don't really know.
What if he was Michael's father? Because we still don't know who he is.
That's true. It's possible. Probably not likely, since when she was Schultz, she was back in New Mexico.
Yeah.
But so it's kind of Michael's far away. He would have had to really follow.
Do we know if that guy's still alive? Yikes.
From all I could see, he was dead.
Okay. Well,
Michael's dad was dead. So
there you go. Four.
Yeah, possibly.
Possibly
more.
Five.
I mean, who knows? Yeah. There could have definitely been more. There's no way of knowing. What do you think so far of what we've covered with this case?
I mean, she sounds like a manipulator. She sounds like a sociopath, honestly. I know that people who, as somebody who's had their own childhood trauma, there are ways of dealing with that trauma that are not always positive, but those people don't typically end up like this. So I find it weird that she uses that as like a crutch almost in her behaviors. First off, if she did attack her father and her stepmother, it's an easy cop out to say, well, they were like abusing me, blah, 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 all this other stuff. And, you know, that might be true. I'm not going to say that it's not. But at the same time, she's shown a like behavior of, she's gotten better at hiding it and being more, you know, intelligent with the way that she carries out harm towards others. But she's shown a history of just getting what she wants and damn whoever gets in her way. So I would find it easy to look back on that and say, you know, maybe that didn't even happen, but she did attack them because they didn't give her something that she wanted, you know?
Yeah. But if you also notice, she's giving herself a justification for everything that she's reported. So if she reports doing a bad thing, there's a reason behind it.
Exactly. That's kind of what I'm getting.
Unless it's an accident.
Too. That's what I'm getting to. Because, you know, you can do something bad and not have an excuse for it. Hell, I've done it. I've done bad things and not had an excuse. But if somebody with an inability to, you know, acknowledge any harm or have any sense of like humbleness within themselves, I mean, that's a sociopath. That is what that is. So I think she was kind of born this way, or her environment did cater to creating, you know, what she has become.
And I don't think it's mutually exclusive, right? She could be born with certain traits and her environment encouraged those specific traits.
Right.
Over other ones.
Right. And I'm not saying that she wasn't abused by any means. She could have been abused. But she also has a history of lying and exaggerating.
And making up stories.
Right. So, I don't know. I find it hard to believe anything she says.
Spoiler alert, Geronimo is not related to her. They actually asked the Native Americans to like go through their histories. And yeah, she's not related to anybody in the Apache tribe at all.
I mean, yeah, so, she was as white as you
spoiler
are.
Spoiler alert. She's not quite. There's definitely a little bit more color to her skin than mine. But that doesn't take much, to be perfectly honest. So in all fairness.
Good Lord.
So yeah, we'll leave it there and then we'll get into part two. We've done pretty good so far, so this might just end up being a two-parter. We'll see how you handle the next half.
Okay.
So.
Well, good job.
See you in a little bit.
Until next time, we love you. We mean it. Oh, wait.
Okay, bye.
We're going to record it now, so we're going to know, but you guys aren't going to know until a week after this is released. Sorry. Okay, bye.
The Reaper will come for us all.